Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, remember, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? My guest on this episode of Hidden Forces is Josh Crum, founder and CEO of Abaxx Technologies, which is launching a new commodity futures exchange in Singapore over the next year. Josh was formerly a macroeconomist and commodity strategist at Goldman Sachs, where he was the head of metal strategy. He is also a co-founder of gold bullion dealer Gold Money and jeweler company Mene. Josh, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, this was a long time in the making, man. How you been?
Absolutely. Good, good. Well, as you know, I'm a big fan of the show and a Patreon member, so great to be able to add some value to your listeners.
I appreciate it, man. So you and I, first, we've met only once, and it was at BetaWorks, where I have my office in Meatpacking. And I was taken aback at what a giant geek you are. And we were supposed to do an episode together to talk at least about the secondary market for trading liquid natural gas, if I remember correctly, LNG. And I just found the conversation fascinating. But it turns out we share so many interests, I think, in the philosophical realm. But you've been in this business for such a long time. So the reason that you're here, I'm not going to bury the lead. An interesting thing happened last week on the COMEX, which is the futures and options market for trading metals in New York. The price of gold in near-dated futures expiring at the end of March spiked by almost 10% to $70 an ounce, above the price of physical gold on the LBMA in London, which is a spot market for trading physical. Now, I'm no gold futures expert, but this was a very steep backwardation of the futures curve. And by backwardation, I mean where the front end of the curve steepens relative to the long end, so that it's actually more expensive to try and get gold now than it would be later in the future. And it's only happened a handful of times in the last 20 years, and one of those times was after Lehman filed for bankruptcy in September 2008. So first, why don't you fill us in on what happened last week, and then I promise for anyone listening that you're going to tell us why this weird price stuff is happening in a futures market in New York and why it actually matters to people buying toilet paper in Nebraska.
Absolutely. No, that's a great intro. And I'd say, you know, also just to not get super technical about, you know, financial markets and backwardations and all of this, you know, also there's probably a lot of listeners that will be quite interested because, you know, I'd say over the last, you know, 10, 20 years or more, I guess one of the narratives that the gold bugs have generally held, well, there was a couple of them that, you know, the gold price is always being manipulated by the big banks. And second, that there's this, you know, large, you know, short interest always coming into the COMEX, suppressing the price, and that eventually someone won't be able to take delivery on all of that, you know, paper gold that's being sold. So we've essentially knocked out two of the, you know, three big conspiracies. The third, of course, being that there's no gold at Fort Knox. We've essentially knocked out two of the three quote unquote conspiracies over the last few years. So, you know, I think this is a major story, both in the minds of gold investors, but also I'd say in, you know, financial markets broadly. And so, yeah, I'm happy to dive into what this means in a very, you know, the very micro and economic sense, you know, what actually happened. The story actually made the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, the day that we're recording. A good friend of mine at the Wall Street Journal, I was actually helping her along with this story over the last week. But, you know, it actually, in my mind, it's a more important story, not necessarily for the micro, but what the actual macro means. The context that, you know, is the canary in the coal mine, and what is the gold price actually telling us about the macro economy? So I think there's a couple of stories to dive into here. But yeah, that's really why I think this is quite interesting.
So tell us what happened, and I'm going to stop you if you use some words that I think people aren't familiar with. You used short interest, you used paper gold. We'll be using those words again, and you can explain to listeners what those are, or I'll prompt you to. But what happened last week?
Yeah, absolutely.
And by the way, we're recording this today on March 28th, okay, in the afternoon, 5 p.m., March 28th. This was last week. So what happened?
Yeah, so basically what happened, you know, a lot of times when people see a price on the screen for the gold price, the oil price, you know, these types of particularly commodity prices, we think about it like it's a price for, you know, shares like, you know, Apple or IBM on stock exchange. But first thing you have to understand about commodities is the price is actually a curve. What you're actually buying when you're buying a futures contract is you're actually buying a contract to buy delivery of a commodity at some point in the future. So typically when we talk about the gold price or the oil price, we're talking about the front month price, the one that's most quoted on, you know, when you're seeing it on a financial news, which is basically means the contract that's available for delivery, you know, nearest in the future.
Near-term future,
exactly. So when we're talking about the gold price on the COMEX, which is part of the CME group, the world's largest commodity exchange group. So the gold price, which is, you know, the COMEX price, is actually for the price that was spiking up was the March delivery contract. So this was the nearest contract in the future, the March delivery contract for 100 ounce, you know, bars of gold. And so the people that are selling those contracts basically have two options. Well, they either make delivery because the buyer actually has a contract to receive physical metal, or they're going to have to try to buy that contract out in cash and roll it sometime in the future. So again, basically people were selling something that they need to be, you know, by the terms of the contract, they need to make good on actually delivering that physical commodity. So what happened this past week is that you had a number of large short people that had sold these, you know, paper gold contracts, but they were not actually able to find the gold to make delivery. And then they actually were not able to also exit the contract very easily because they had to buy back the contract to try to move it into the future.
Well, when you say they couldn't find the gold, what do you mean? Where was it? What do you mean they couldn't find the gold?
So they actually could not come up with physical bars of gold to make delivery. So again, you know, we've started, you know, very technical.
They owed X amount in physical gold and they literally couldn't find something to buy to make good on their commitment.
That's correct. Yeah. So they're actually short something that they could not make delivery. They had sold something they could not actually deliver. So what happened then is the futures market. So again, and when I'm talking about COMEX, I'm talking about like the New York futures market for gold. There was no gold available. However, the world's largest spot gold market is actually in London, the LBMA gold market. And this was always the rebuttal to, you know, again, the gold bugs that all this paper gold, these contracts could never actually be fulfilled in a time of market panic. And what, you know, the pushback to that argument has always been, well, there's plenty of gold. There's plenty of gold in the world. There's plenty of gold in the London vaults. There's plenty of gold. So we can always just get gold from somewhere else in time that contract is expiring and make good on our delivery. So even if we don't necessarily have the gold right now, we can always go out and find it and make delivery because gold, you know, gold is not a commodity like oil, which gets consumed. It's a commodity that gets produced and essentially, you know, lasts forever. So basically what happened is we had this major breakdown in supply chains because of the coronavirus and you know, refiners stopping work. And then just an overall, you know, so we had a lot of difficulty in moving gold to the place that it needs to be delivered. At the same time, we've had a massive surge in demand for gold because of the financial system turbulence and what's going on in credit markets. So we had a large demand for gold physically at the same time where it was very hard to make physical delivery. So that's essentially what happened with this price spiking quite significantly.
So how much of that was because of transportation? And how much of that was because the actual supply itself, the production, was disrupted, like gold refiners?
Yeah, so It really is a bit of both, right? And then I guess, unfortunately, to add a third variable to the mix, it's also what very specifically that contract is. You know, that contract very specifically is for 100 troy ounce bars of gold, whereas most of the London metal is 400 ounce bars. So theoretically, even if you chartered an airplane and moved the gold from London, it's actually not the product you've sold in your contract. So again, there's a number of things, but I would actually say it's a mixture of all three.
So why does that matter, though? If I bought 400 ounces of gold, why do I need to have them in 100 ounce bars? Why can't I just get one 400 ounce? Like, why does that materially matter?
Because that is the contract. So again, this is actually quite important that these commodity markets are real contracts, right? It's almost like saying, well, you know what? I actually can't find the Google stock I sold short, but here I'm going to deliver Facebook instead. So yes, again, theoretically gold is gold, but you actually have a contract for a very specific product. And that's, you know, the integrity of these commodity future markets. It's very important to make sure that you can actually deliver the spec that's needed for the supply chain.
So let's actually also take a moment to describe what a futures curve looks like. When we're talking about backwardation, we're talking about an inversion of the term structure so that it's actually cheaper to buy gold further out. So you're seeing a spike in the price of short-term futures relative to the long end of the term structure. What does that mean in practical terms beyond the fact that, and also what does the spot price look like at that time? What did it cost to buy gold right then and there in the spot market?
Yeah, so I don't have the prices in front of me exactly, but I think it was somewhere around $1,600, $20, something in that general range. And so basically you had a spike of up to $70 above that price of what was theoretically a spot market for London gold. And so, you know, that's a very, very big spread. And for something like gold, it'd be very easy to move it from one place to another to arbitrage the price to, you know, buy gold cheaper somewhere else, fly it to this market. So, and I will dive into that a little bit more. In fact, that's actually quite important. And it's actually the important part of this story is this, you know, this is where the canary in the coal mine is in my mind, is that, you know, these financial markets, often people talk about speculation and speculation in the oil price, speculation in grain prices and all these other commodities. But what's actually quite important is most of the commodity world trades not necessarily speculation, but they're actually mostly trading arbitrage. And this is where these price signals and these different futures curves really matter for, you know, again, this is why it matters for the Main Street economy. So what happens is there's really a couple parts of that futures curve that really matters. So unlike a security, unlike a stock or a bond, a commodity has to be produced, it has to be transported, and it has to be stored before it can be consumed. So unlike, you know, paper financial products, which are theoretically instantaneous to move, you know, around the world. I mean, they're not necessarily instantaneous. There's still settlement and all sorts of other things happening. But let's just, you know, imagine for a minute when you press enter and click buy or sell on your screen for a security, more or less can, you know, because it's a digital contract, it generally can move very quickly. However, in a physical market, if I buy oil, I actually need to put it somewhere, right? I have to get it from somewhere. So that's why there's a curve of where and when you actually want to buy something. So basically, and again, this is the industry jargon, but you've got a contango and a backwardation. So a contango means that this near-term price, you know, again, this March price is cheaper than the price in, say, you know, December. And you're actually buying a commodity at a discount today versus the future because there's plenty of storage. And once you buy it, you're going to have to store it.
And that's a steep curve, right? So the backwardation is an inversion of the futures curve. A contango is steepening of that curve.
Yeah. So contango means today's price is cheaper than the price in the future. A backwardation means today's price is higher than the price of in the future. And what that means is there's actually a premium to buy something today. Because there's low inventories, there's low storage, I'm going to have to pay more for it now than I am at the future because I'm not sure if I can find it in the future. Right. So the backwardation actually can be thought of as a premium to the, you know, to the fundamental price of the commodity. Whereas a contango, you're basically buying something at a discount to the fundamental price because you're going to have to store it somewhere because there's plenty of availability.
So is that another way of saying that a market that's showing backwardation is a market that is spiking in terms of demand? There's scarcity there's an impulse of demand, and whatever it is that you're trading in is not readily available. Whereas in the case of contango, there's an excess of supply or a drop in demand, and so there's no immediate need to have the underlying for the futures contract, and so you get that steepening.
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, in today's market, you know, bringing this back to real time, you can actually see that the difference is quite significant. And again, in the gold issue that I was just talking about versus oil. So in the gold market, there was, you know, physically no gold, right? That you had dealers, you know, basically calling all around North America to try to secure inventory to make delivery, because again, there was too many people that sold and there was not enough inventory to actually make good on the delivery. So you had people all over trying to source inventory, and there was a shortage. So this backwardation, this price spiked to need it in the near term. Whereas in oil, the exact opposite is happening, where we're seeing the oil price go down and down and down, not necessarily in the futures curve, but in the near term price, because we have nowhere to put it. We actually can't consume all this oil that's being produced. So you actually buy it at a discount because you're going to have to find a place to store it. So again, that's in real time, we're seeing a very big difference between a commodity like gold, which we really need now, or people are demanding highly now, versus oil, which, you know, we do believe we're going to still need it in the future. But right now we're way over supplied. And so the price is collapsing in the front. So again, these are the two very different dynamics of supply and demand for products that, you know, again, theoretically in the future, they can be very well correlated. But in the near term, you've got these very big dislocations and volatility in these markets.
So when you were talking about people frantically calling dealers in New York to try and source gold, I read that Wall Street Journal article, and I think your partner at Gold Money, he got phone calls with offers of $100 an ounce to pay him over spot or over near-term futures?
Yes, exactly. And I should say, I no longer work at Gold Money, but
okay.
Again, helped found
former.
That business.
Right.
But yes, you know, from my understanding, that's exactly what happened is, and again, I remember this from years back in building the business. You know, for instance, we had a lot of, you know, kilo bars being held for customers and so forth. So we had the type of gold in New York that people were scrambling for. And so what the banks and the dealers wanted to do was swap it for, you know, the 400 ounce bars or something bigger so that they could find this material and deliver it into their contract. So again, there was a scramble all over to try to find this metal.
So this is really interesting to go back to your point about arbitrage, and you may want to define this for our listeners so people understand what it is. But this is exactly what arbitrage is. You have dislocation between markets for the same exact thing. So you have gold being priced at one level in one market, and then in over the counter with gold money is getting offers of $100 over spot, right? So there's a kind of arbitrage is like trying to create thermodynamic equilibrium between markets. You've got some markets that are hotter than others, and you want to get to a lukewarm temperature, right?
Absolutely. And so again, that goes back to the point that I was trying to make that, you know, as much as we think about this stuff as all speculation, it's actually price signals that give us very, very important information. Again, if price is spiking over in one region, but it isn't in another, it's signaling to the market, hey, line up an airplane, line up a boat, you know, get material from one place to another. So it's actually market coordination to figure out where somebody needs something right now. On a very localized hyperscale, that's what electricity markets do as well. So, you know, things can spike and discount so that the market can coordinate where we actually need these physical commodities moved around the world. So what arbitrage is, again, if the price is 10% higher over in one place than it is in another, or, you know, I'm not sure if it quite got to 10%, but, you know, again, just exaggerating for a second, but it only costs 2% to actually, you know, ship it from one place to another. An arbitrage would collect that delta. They connect the difference between the premium that's being paid in one place and the cost of moving it from somewhere else. So that actually isn't a speculation. That's actually just closing a price signal or an arbitrage, and you make money not necessarily taking risk, but having the ability to take it from one place to another.
So how much open interest was there towards the end of March?
Yeah. So again, I'm not in the depths of this market right now, but it did spike to, you know, higher levels than usual. And what it turns out as sort of know the next day, I mean, this is all happening in real time. This has all been happening in the last week, and there's no necessarily certainty that it's going to get sorted out even for the next contract. But with all that said, what it looks like was happening, there was really a physical shortage, right? And a lot of that has to do with refiners and mints shutting down due to, you know, coronavirus, you know, supply chain, you know, shut-ins and work stoppages. But at the same time, you've had this spike in demand. And so again, I don't have the data right in front of me, but I think what's probably more important once we look back at what actually happened is what we see is that this looked like a financial short squeeze. So basically, it was a group of, you know, banks or hedge funds on one side saying, hey, I've done my research and I don't think you can actually make delivery. I don't think there's gold around here. So I'm going to go and buy it now. And they probably offset it with a selling it sometime in the future. So they weren't actually long gold. They were just long premium, right? So they were actually long. They were trying to force banks that they thought didn't have supply to buy it from them. So there was a lot of volume and open interest in essentially what looked like a, you know, financial poker game, a game of chicken of buyers and sellers. However, as it turns out, after that contract expired and we moved on to delivery, you know, the front month delivery being the April contract, it actually immediately almost crashed into a contango. So basically what happened is even all those people that were buying, they were actually trying to buy gold to squeeze out the people that they thought couldn't deliver it. But even though they bought that to squeeze them, it turns out they weren't set up to take delivery either. So this really was just a financial game. And so when they're not actually set up to physically take the delivery of the gold, they then have to move forward to the next contract. So they were forced sellers. And so they actually sold and drove the premiums negative in the next contract. So the reason all this matters is because there were real companies, you know, real jewelry companies, you know, real physical users of gold that could not find material in this mad scramble to try to close a short interest. And ultimately, the people that had bought up that gold didn't want it either. So it was really a game of chicken that's really disrupted the physical industry.
So a couple questions. One, what roughly speaking percentage of the market actually uses the futures market to settle in physical and actually needs it for some underlying real-world purpose, like making jewelry, for example? And then two, if these hedge funds, for example, speculating in gold futures, bidding the price up and squeezing everyone who was short, how did that fund get caught on the long side as the price collapsed? Was there an expectation that there weren't as many people trying to squeeze the shorts as there actually were?
Yeah, again, this is all sort of happening in real time. So I don't know the full data. I just saw the price that the April to June spread went negative. So again, it went into a huge discount, which looked to me like, as I tweeted, you know, it's the equivalent of going to the supermarket and, you know, going to buy toilet paper and the store pays you to take toilet paper away that doesn't exist.
That's contango.
Yeah, exactly. Except that the inventory wasn't actually there. So again, it went discount into contango, even though we know that the gold wasn't
so
there.
Interesting.
So again, that's why we've got, you know, a very interesting scenario where the inventory really is extremely scarce. But at the same time, you know, you've got prices, you know, swinging all over the place because there's a lot of financial games going on.
So this is where we get now. Now, this is the, I promised listeners we're going to get to the really interesting part. I think we did the basic work to set the foundation here. So one of the things that I find fascinating about the story is it highlights the discrepancy between the financial economy and the real economy, right? And the financial economy, in this case, is the futures and options market and market for derivatives. And the real economy is the underlying physical use cases of gold, or even people who actually want to take delivery of gold, want to own it, have it in a vault, their vault, some other vault, wherever. Talk to me about the significance of this. What does this tell us about the relationship between these two markets, and why is it important?
Yeah, so the reason I found this so important is, again, I believe that we're in the front end of some pretty significant economic turmoil. I mean, we saw the initial jobless claims last week that, you know, 3.2 million applied for unemployment insurance, which I think was triple the largest in history previously. And so, yes, I mean, I believe we're in a major economic dislocation. And again, one of the first goods that you buy when people are looking for safety, looking for security, one of the first things people will buy in an economic and financial, a potential financial crisis like this, is gold. So it's, again, it's the equivalent of going to the grocery store. And yeah, most of the goods are fine, but there's a few of them that, you know, for whatever reason, people are jumping to hoard first, right? So there's, you know, whether it's eggs and rice and toilet paper.
Although it turns out that toilet paper is something you don't really need to, even though this is what I've titled the episode, it's actually not something I've learned recently. It's not something you need to hoard because I think it's produced domestically. There's no shortage. It was just an issue of getting it to the store. But we're not in a situation like with other things that need to come from halfway around the world, and we don't know when they're going to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, we kind of joke that, you know, at one point almost our entire economy was trees. There's no shortage of toilet paper.
Yeah, you guys could use the leaves.
Right. So you know, again, that was the joke. But at the same time, why I find this so interesting and something to really, you know, it's a signal. And, you know, and we should see, without always dismissing prices and markets as, oh, that market's just rigged or this. What it is, it's a signal. It's a signal that there's a lot of fear, and we need to be thinking about where these next goods are coming from. And again, going back to commodity markets with these, you know, why we spend so much time in contangos and backwardations, that's a very important price signal that we need to move goods this place, or we need to store it now, we need to move it over there, we need to produce more, we need to consume less. So that's what these price signals are always trying to do. And what I think is, I think we're in the, you know, first or second inning of this. And so we need to be seeing these price signals and these shortages as a bigger macroeconomic issue.
All right. So there are two different kind of stories here. One is the gold story. What is the backwardation of gold itself signaling? And then there's a larger story, which is, what is gold signaling as a commodity for what we are seeing in the global economy, specifically with global supply chains? So let's actually put a pin in the gold specific story of like people's fear and the fear index or whatever. Not the fear index, the VIX, but, you know, the fear index of gold, the classical fear index. And let's focus on this idea that gold could be a canary in the coal mine for something much deeper that's going on in the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So maybe going back, and I guess before I even really got into gold markets, you know, copper markets, I'm actually an engineer by background and from the Colorado School of Mines. And so I actually started an industry in mining and particularly in base metals and copper. You know, there's really two signals that have been very important to the global economy in the metals markets. One being the gold price for all the reasons we just discussed, and the other one being the copper price, which, you know, a lot of people say is Dr. Copper. You know, the price of copper is the signal for what's happening in the broader economy, the industrial economy, whereas gold is a signal of what's happening in the financial economy. So both of these prices actually send important signals, not only in their local markets, but also in the macroeconomy as a whole. So when I was at Goldman Sachs in 2010 and 2011, one thing, you know, I helped develop along with some of my colleagues, a new theory of backwardation, or I'd say maybe a expanded theory of backwardation. And what I was specifically trying to understand is, at the end of the day, copper, there's not a lot of people actually price sensitive to copper and the things that we use it in. So if I look at a Tesla electric vehicle and all of the copper that it needs, or, you know, or a new power plant being built in China, these demand a lot of copper. But at the end of the day, the price tag on a Tesla, the copper price is irrelevant to that use. Same with a power plant. You don't stop a power plant because, you know, the copper price doubled. So how is it exactly that we ration supply and demand? And does that price, you know, that very specific commodity, does it tell a bigger story? So what I ended up working out, and again, started with an anecdote, and then we actually started mathematically modeling a lot of this stuff, was when I was building a house back in 2006, 2007, and the copper price had just started moving from, you know, a long-term sort of 90 cents, a dollar a pound, up to $2.50, $3 a pound. So again, the price was tripling at that time. I was building a house, and I remember the construction manager once saying, I don't care if the price of copper is $20. I'm sick of waiting and holding up this entire home build because I can't find grounding cable, or I can't find a new copper pipe, right? So what I started thinking about is, actually, it's not the price that matters as much as the volatility in the signal. Hmm. It's the change in price that actually slows down the economy, which that's actually how you ration something, which at the end of the day is very price inelastic. I'll probably throw out some engineering jargon, some trading jargon, and economics jargon. So apologies for that. But again, the demand's not very responsive to the price. So what needs to happen actually is volatility needs to increase. So it's actually volatility that increases that's actually more important than the pricing increasing. So let's go back to example, again, very specifically to the gold market that we just talked about. So if you go on, you know, March 26th, and the price is, you know, 7% higher in the very short term, but then by Friday, March 27th, the price is a major discount. Even though the gold supply in general in London was very stable, you know, again, theoretically, you had this wild price swing in the near-term physical gold market, which would affect somebody like a jeweler. So let's say they bought their gold without hedging, but they bought that price in a very scarcity environment on Wednesday, but then they actually produced something and sold it, you know, on Friday when the price swung that wildly. That's 10% swing, you know, from the front end of the factory to the end of the factory could actually wipe out their entire margin. So this is where volatility actually becomes far and more important than price. So we might not have slowed down, you know, jewelry sales between Wednesday and Friday. And in fact, at the gold jewelry company I started, Manet, we actually, you know, our jewelry sales were increasing with the increasing price. So it wasn't necessarily the price effect, but the supply chain effect is where we actually start having economic distortions and slowing down the economy.
So how does volatility create slowdowns in the supply chain? Or is it reflecting a slowdown in the supply chain, or both?
So this, yeah, exactly. This one's a little bit of a chicken and egg. And unfortunately, it's also probably a negative feedback loop or a positive feedback loop, right? So when volatility is low, when there's plenty of inventory, there's plenty of certainty where my next good is going to come from, or my next input is going to come from, then people can increase leverage, increase production. It's actually very easy to sort of plan your economic environment, particularly when there's, you know, fairly stable growth. However, when there's high volatility, I don't know where my next stocks are coming from. I don't know where my next commodities are coming from. I don't know if I'm going to have to pay a premium or I can buy it at a discount and store it. This is the problem where people then just kind of slow down. So they actually look at it and they say, okay, well, maybe I just need to hold higher inventories, which means that they can't be as high financially geared, right? So they actually have to pay and there's going to be a lot of capital tied up in that inventory.
You lose some of that efficient allocation of capital.
Exactly. So that's where price signals, particularly in these commodity markets, matter so much. It's really about the efficiency and coordination of the market.
So that's really, you know, again, I'm thinking about this metaphor of thermodynamics. A volatile environment is a higher temperature environment. It's a gaseous environment. It's difficult to form a liquid in such an environment. And similarly, if prices are very volatile for the inputs that you're using for your production, that can grind economic activity to a halt or have a negative impact on economic growth. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have this, and to your point, though, so we've got this entire economy that's built on just-in-time inventory that searches for efficiencies everywhere. And in the case of disruptions, either to physical supply chains or to credit markets, which you rely on in order to not have to depend on having large cash balances, all that gets disrupted, right? Because this is how our economy functions right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so this is where I actually believe, and again, that's sort of the signal I've been saying that the gold market is projecting here. I actually think we're in the midst of something that's both. It's both a physical disruption in the economy as well as a financial disruption. Whereas in 2009, you know, it was mostly a financial disruption that then, you know, temporarily created a physical disruption that we then had to sort of learn to grow back out of and, you know, allow people to take more risk, not be so conservative, right? So the economy has its own sort of reaction function to these types of shocks. But what we're having now is both the financial shock as well as some very extreme supply and demand shocks that are happening because of how rapidly we've shut in the global economy. And so whereas the last one probably started as a financial, well, I'd say the mainstream view is the last crisis started as a financial crisis that fed into the real economy. I actually don't believe that as a commodity person. I actually believe it was commodity markets that shocked the system and created the financial crisis. But again, that's potentially a whole nother episode.
That's what I was going to ask you. I was like, should I take the risk of asking you? But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, I still believe it was a physical shock that created a financial shock that then became another physical shock. Whereas this one, it was a physical one creating a financial shock. And then again, I think it's going to be a prolonged physical shock coming back out of it.
So you're saying a disruption in supply chains caused a shock to the futures market. The futures market fed back into supply chains, and it's a positive feedback loop.
Correct. Exactly. And because we don't know how severe we're shocking, even just our perceptions of the economy. Again, you mentioned just-in-time inventory. You know, and again, I would say some of this probably already, there's probably a lot of questions about that, even with what was some of the things that were happening in the trade wars, you know, this sort of year, and I'd say on a bigger front, you know, the years preceding that. So we had already had some questions about supply chains and, you know, particularly in energy markets, we're totally remapping supply chains now with what's gone in U.S. shale. And so there's all sorts of, you know, big macro structural trends that have already been changing. But I guess my point is, after we go through this, you know, what could be a very short physical shock to the economy, but extremely dramatic, we could come out of this on the other side of the recession, totally rethinking how we're doing inventories and supply chains. And in my mind, that will slow down the economy for quite some time.
So is this kind of like a violent unwinding of global supply chains and all these interconnected relationships among producers and suppliers?
I do, because there's also going to be a total shock to demand expectations, right? So, you know, again, you think about something like the restaurant industry or tourism, you know, this is not a V-shaped recovery, right? People are going to actually totally rethink just the way they interact in the physical economy with strangers and transportation, everything else.
This means like more vertical integration of companies. It also means, I'm guessing, sourcing materials closer to home that require less assumptions, less intermediaries between the input you need and your factory or whatever else it might be. Is this what we're talking about? Like, how can I visualize this?
Yes, I believe so. And so maybe to go back to another anecdote for a second. And again, this is kind of where also I developed this theory of volatility in supply chains. It was actually back in 2011 with the nuclear crisis at Fukushima. So essentially, as a copper analyst and as a commodity economist, I went in to look at, okay, what is the supply and demand effects of this? And then you start thinking about it, okay, you know, Japan is no longer, you know, a major player in copper demand or supply. They probably were in the 80s with their smelting and supply chains. But what I ended up discovering is there's this very specific niche in sort of copper electrical components where something like 90% of the market was actually being supplied by these manufacturers in northern Japan. And so basically what I came to think is, if I'm just going to be sort of bean counting the global, you know, copper market supply and demand, it was actually quite insignificant what happened in this very localized region. However, those electrical components that were all sort of bottleneck in that specific part of Japan, that's now slowed down the entire German manufacturing industry with automobiles. That's now, at the time, it very much slowed down Boeing and Airbus and a lot of the components used in airplanes. So again, a very small supply chain shock in one sort of local region of a, you know, geographically small country in the world really slowed down the global economy in manufacturing. So what we're going to see over the next 6 months is rolling little disruptions that we never really thought about, that they were bottlenecks. And so again, when that happens, the reaction to that is going to be try to be, you know, yet again, more diversified, broader supply chains. But there's two problems with that. You know, part of it is supply chain, you want to have physical diversity because of geographic events or again, sort of physical economy reactions, but also financially, right? So it's also not very good to run a supply chain with counterparty risk to, you know, dozens and dozens of suppliers in case their credit is not good. So again, there's always this interaction. As much as we want to say there's the real economy and the financial economy, they actually both can have an ability to have shocks that affect everything.
It's like an unwinding of assumptions, right? I mean, there's something that is synonymous or correlates with volatility, like, again, assumptions or uncertainty, right? So like we're talking about a more uncertain economic future. This also reminds me of my conversation with Peter Zeihan, the geopolitical side of it, at least, with the reordering of the global order and his forecasts or predictions for where we were headed. And it was a world where very much everyone is kind of retrenching. Everyone is receding, pulling back, and trying to basically play it more safe, right? Like you're not taking advantage of those efficiencies. You're actually just focusing on controlling more of what you have in front of you, what you know, what you can manage, and decreasing your risk levels, right? Not just financially in terms of having higher cash balances, which we know about in terms of in a deflationary sense, but actually decreasing the steps from A to B to C to your final customer, right? I mean, this is what we're describing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I think that was already happening sort of geopolitically, again, over the last few years and the rise of, you know, sort of populism and sort of a retrenchment of nationalism and economic nationalism. So again, these things were already happening. And then I would say at the same time, so again, you're creating less resiliency. So locally, you feel like it's more certain, but from a global context, you're probably making things less efficient, you know, again, all else equal. But then also at the same time, what we had in the financial markets is a lot of these companies that were also sort of, you know, retrenching their supply chains, or, you know, there's a lot of political pressure for them to retrench supply chains. What they were doing in financial markets was they were actually hollowing out their resiliency in their balance sheet by essentially taking more and more corporate leverage to buy back more and more stock. So at the same time, we're already sort of shifting, we're going through this sort of phase transition in the supply chain networks and the economic networks of physical goods. And at the same time, we had hollowed out the balance sheet of corporations and made them very much vulnerable to an economic shock. And so I would actually say a lot of this was already, we already started seeing the cracks of this back, you know, as early as sort of Q4 of 2018. It was actually in Q4 of 2018 when we had some big sell-offs in equity markets. And we sort of forget about it because of the euphoria of the price run up until the virus of, say, you know, Q4 of 19 and Q1 of 2020 with, you know, Tesla going to 900 and all of the things that were happening in the stock. Yeah, so all of these things are happening in the stock market, which I think was distracting what was actually happening in the underlying economy, is everything was becoming very unstable. So, you know, economic peak, the rate of change growth in global economic growth actually peaked way back in Q4 of 2018. So the rate of global growth sort of accelerating peaked. Now, it was still growing, but it was on a decelerating basis sort of throughout 2018. So there's a lot of us in economics that I actually already believed we were going to be entering a major, you know, recessionary environment and potentially some very bad financial ramifications. But then all of that got accelerated by the coronavirus shocks, both in the physical economy as well as the financial economy.
So this has, I think, direct implications for one of the hopes that many people have, which is that, and it's not just actually hopes, it's also, I think, a selling point that's been made on financial media, which is that when we get out of this, like, this is bad, this is hard, you know, the situation we're in, but once we get out, boy, is it going to be a rip-roaring recovery. We're going to have a massively V-shaped recovery. But what you're describing is actually an economy that doesn't roar out of what this just, I don't know, unprecedented, crazy situation that we're currently in, but actually just kind of stagnates out. It just muddles on through. Is that what we're talking about here? Because there's so much instability.
I wish I could be that optimistic.
So what do you think? I mean, what are we looking at? Is it something like the, because I was thinking 70s. I was thinking 1970s where there was price volatility. It was actually to the upside. So you had double-digit inflation and you also had stagnation in the economy. So that's not exactly what you're looking at?
That's exactly what I'm looking at. I actually believe that one of the things that I find incredibly, I'd say, disheartening is watching our political financial media and our financial media, you know, telling these narratives of, hey, you know, this isn't a big deal. We're, you know, yes, it's dramatic, but we're just going to take, you know, 3 weeks off, maybe 3 months off, and then we can kind of get back to normal, right? As long as we throw enough money at the problem and we plug all these holes, we're just going to get back to normal. And in my view, that's just not how it works for, you know, many of the reasons we've just explained. So add to that a total retrenchment and conservatism, as you mentioned, you know, that I think is going to be ingrained. You know, again, in the financial economy, we talk about that being retrenching and building, you know, building a savings glut and all of that. But in the physical economy, it really is, you know, really, really just slowing down. And so I think it's going to be very hard to see this V-shaped recovery coming out of it. So, you know, I think, you know, my former colleagues at Goldman, you know, I think they were saying, yeah, you know, the Dow is going to sell off to, you know, 20,000, which we touched last week. But then, you know, by the end of the year, it's going to be back up at 30,000. And I just do not see that world at all. And I guess my frustration and one of the reasons why I'm doing, you know, podcasts like this is because I think people need to look at reality. I think people need to be prepared for reality, because we've had many, many years of financial cheerleading not telling us that there was actually something much bigger problems under the surface of the stock market price. And that's the story I'm trying to tell. And that is, you know, we need to take this seriously. You know, I'm a snowboarder from Colorado. So, you know, backcountry, and, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, sure, you know, going on these things can be fun, but you have to respect the mountain, right? It's not just, oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. You have to prepare. You have to know what you're doing. And I think that's the problem is, you know, we're on this sort of, you know, financial bubble, which is a great, you know, fun spring break ski trip, but people aren't looking at the reality of the mountain underneath. And is this a safe place to be? And I think that we need to come to reality and start preparing our financial lives and sort of our economic lives for the reality that we could be heading into a depression. And I just think people are too afraid to say those words, even though that's exactly what things like the gold price are telling us.
So, okay, a few questions. Or actually, one question which covers both. What is the gold price telling us? So not everything we just discussed right now, which was one particular part of the market in a very specific time domain, but actually the gold price from, say, the summer of 2019, what has the rise of gold in the last 18 months been telling us? What has the rise of its price been telling us?
Yeah, exactly. No, it's a great question because, again, you know, very much like I mentioned that, you know, really the credit markets and the global economy really peaked in 2018 and had been rolling over. And basically the gold price was doing something similar. So the gold price was, you know, relatively stable the last few years, but it was really in about last summer. So gold price was around 1300. And some of my former colleagues at Goldman and then at Gold Money published a report how, you know, basically that it was, you know, as we say, game, you know, in from the old Wayne's world, you know, game on. So we saw a gold price moving up from 1300 to about 1600 starting last summer. And that really played out. And what happened is, you know, basically, you know, for, you know, we were going through this phase transition in the global economy and the global financial system where people were like, you know, maybe we can keep going. Maybe we can extend this economic recovery for another year, another 2 years. Sure, growth isn't great, but maybe we can just keep kind of muddling along at sort of, you know, 2.5-3% global growth. But I think it became pretty apparent by summer of last year that narrative just wasn't holding up. We started seeing cracks in the financial system and the flow of credit back in 2018. And essentially, we ended up, you know, basically the Fed back in mid last year essentially said, basically abandoning their forward guidance and that they're actually going to start shifting back to easing. So they sort of gave up on this real interest rate, you know, that there's real growth in the economy back last summer. And so we sort of slowly saw gold prices ticking up from there. But then what happened is in Q4, we actually started seeing some interesting things happening, what no one could really explain around spikes in repo markets. And essentially the Fed had to embark on, you know, what all of us were sort of mockingly called not QE. So that all started happening in September of last year. So again, we already started seeing these cracks at really the core of the financial system. And at that price, gold was already roaring. But again, you know, back to what was happening, unfortunately, to the mainstream narrative is, you know, you had, you know, videos of us, you know, killing it on the economy, greatest economy ever, stock markets at all-time highs. But that's not what the bond market was saying. That's not what the gold market was saying. So we're getting fed a cheerleading story to, hey, yeah, just go down that chute. It's going to be fine. Whereas, you know, the credit market is saying, hey, these might be avalanche conditions. Let's be a little bit more careful here.
You know, I think one of the things that's really interesting hearing you talk about this, Josh, is that I think more people than ever, certainly if you compare to 2008 and 2000, felt that there was something wrong in the popular narrative, right? They looked around them and they felt like the world that they saw, even if they were doing well, right? Even if you're living in Manhattan and you're doing well, still, you can see from stories, you can see from politics that the last few years in our politics, right, have been so divided. People knew that something wasn't right. And yet, markets kept going up, right? And that dislocation was always present. But I think, and I'll ask you what you think about this, because this kind of is relevant. I think for me, the question always was, how much power do the authorities and central banks in particular have to continue to sustain asset prices to be divorced from the underlying economy, right? And I still wonder about that because they really are as determined as I've ever seen them. And in this case, one of the things that's kind of shocking in a sense, I mean, although there is an immediate economic need for fiscal stimulus in this disaster that we're in, but the sensitivity of the Fed to the stock market, it feels like it's not hidden today. There isn't a pretense like there would have been 20 years ago, right? And even 20 years ago, I don't think that they would have been this sensitive to stock market moves. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying I think people always kind of knew that something was wrong, and it doesn't feel so shocking to me that it's happening. And I wonder if people feel that way as well. In other words, if they're less shocked this time around than they were in 2008 or in 2000.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be my sense. You know, of course, again, I've got a lot of gold clients and I'm in these sort of physical economies in a pretty direct way. So, you know, maybe I'm just, you know, seeing what I've been seeing for a while. But yeah, I think so. I think there's this sort of rush to the narrative of we kind of forgot, you know, it took us almost 5 years to crawl out of, you know, this sort of Occupy narrative, right? That, hey, we bailed out all the bankers and, you know, and people were really pissed off for years and years and years, as they should have been, right? As they should have been. But what happened is this sort of, you know, and again, it's sort of in parts of the country and in parts of the economy that continued, right? And so that's why we've seen this economic populism and economic nationalism sort of rising in these little pockets around the world. But that said, there were also big pockets that were like, actually, everything's fine, right? We're getting wealthier. You know, jobs are good. Tech, you know, we're building all this new technology. You know, the world's getting better. And so you sort of had this bifurcated economy. And there's a lot of people, and I think they're still there, that are really in power that convince themselves, you know what? We did fix the problem by printing money. Yeah, sure. You know, bankers got rich, but, you know, that was a cost benefit analysis.
Dude, it was play pretend. Play pretend.
Yeah.
Play pretend.
But look how good we ended up making it, right? But what happened is I think all this narrative is rushing back. And we're in inning one or two here. I just think even 1 month from now, that narrative, I mean, just even what happened after, you know, yet again, you know, a little bit of dangling, a little bit of money for Main Street and bigger money for, you know, corporations that essentially hollowed out their supply chain or hollowed out their financial resiliency to withstand a shock. You know, they got the bigger piece of the pie, and even Congress getting, you know, basically a subsidized, you know, budget for their emergency preparation. You know, there's all these sort of things. It's like, wait a minute, this, I think we're getting ripped off again. And I saw that happening last week. But as this stock market and as things take another leg down, this whole thing is going to rush back at us extremely hard. And again, these are the kind of things that look, I don't know what's going to come out on the other side. But I'm just saying we need to be preparing ourselves because I believe the world has changed forever at this point. This is not 2008. This is something totally new. And we just need to prepare ourselves.
You know, another thing I'm thinking about when you're talking, Josh, I think I don't know how old you are exactly, but I'm pretty sure you're not old enough to have been working on Wall Street in 1987. Neither was I. But I have a sense that no one was worried that the society would collapse when 87 happened, right? And 87, I think, was the biggest stock market crash in a single day in history, right? 22%?
So I was 7 years old.
Okay, yeah, exactly. No,
I was definitely not in that market.
No. All right, I don't know. I mean, it's trying to do math right now this late in the afternoon is a stretch. But you know, I think we've gotten to a place where we've hitched our societal and political wagon to the stock market. And now with what's going on, it doesn't just feel like a market collapse. You need to be able to have healthy clearing mechanisms, right? And that involves price declines and liquidations and bankruptcies. That doesn't happen anymore. And I feel like we're at a place now where our political stability is tied up in what happens to our markets, and our markets are tied up to what happens in our economies. And actually vice versa too, right? So I worry about that, man. This time does feel different. It feels way scarier because we've shut down the economy. Like, we've shut it down. You know, I'm also a Greek citizen. I'm not just an American citizen. And Greece has been very effective in mitigating the spread. Like, their curve is starting to flatten already. They've gotten great, you know, praise internationally. I don't know what they are doing to test and contact trace, you know? So I don't know how viable that strategy is. But the bigger problem for a country like Greece, and I bring it up for a good reason, is, you know, the United States, even if it shuts down its entire economy, because the dollar is the global reserve currency, it still has value, and Americans can still buy things with dollars. But a country like Greece, well, okay, it's connected to the euro, that's true. But there comes a point where a country like Greece can't afford to shut down. You know, it's a vacation destination, right? A lot of its income is generated from tourism. Its domestic farming industry was hollowed out over the last few decades with the European agricultural policy. So these types of situations are very scary. And Western countries, us living in the West, we haven't really lived in such a situation where the government's ability to provide for the food security of its citizenry has come into question. And I genuinely worry about that, man. Like, you know, I've never seen this before. Like, even during Sandy, I mean, you knew it was a hurricane. There wasn't any question about where the food was going to come from. It's a crazy time. Yeah, it is worrisome, you know, to be fair.
Yeah, and I think that's what I've sort of tried to say. And you know, unfortunately, you know, I don't like to be the person coming in here saying, you know, just buy gold, that's the only solution, right? So, because that's not a solution. What I'm trying to talk about is people just need to really, really think about, you know, how we solve these problems. And I think a lot of it is going to have to come back down to local governments. And like you said, sort of retrench into things that you have a little bit more direct control over outcomes, right? So I think when you say, you know, just throw money at problems, I totally agree. And again, that's coming from a highly centralized, highly disconnected from mainstream scenario. Again, it's, you know, I wasn't in Washington last week when all of these relief, you know, budgets and programs were being put together. But, you know, if a lot of them hadn't been spending a lot of time in their local communities, I think they can be very, very disconnected to what the real problems are. Now, that all said, you know, I still am a very optimistic. You know, I think one of the good things that's going to come out of this is local community, is actually a realization for what jobs really matter, right? And the jobs that really matter are, you know, sort of frontline, you know, workers in the food supply chain and in healthcare and hospitals. And the rally around this, you know, that we're seeing globally of the, you know, the clips of, you know, people in their balconies singing songs and cheering, you know, frontline workers. That's actually the economy that I think we need to return to, right? Is this sense of community and local that has been really hollowed out by these very abstract, far-flung supply chains and finance fixing all problems and, hey, let's just pump some more money into some machine in the bank over there and we're going to hope that it trickles up everywhere else, right? So again, I think a positive takeaway from this is, you know, I think humans are far more resilient and our economy will be resilient. I'm just warning that it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And we need to sort of focus on the fact that, you know, that our real economy is those doctors and those food supply chain workers.
So I have one more question, Josh, before I let you go. And this is, to be clear, not financial advice. I am not a financial advisor. Nothing I or Josh say can or should be viewed as financial advice. But it has to do with gold. Well, actually, let me rewind a second because we talked about the 1970s, this stagflationary period. This is a period of high volatility and also inflation, double-digit inflation, and a lot of inflation in commodity prices. Guys like Jim Rogers and George Soros made a lot of money doing what was effectively commodity trend following, something that I talked about with Chris Cole on one of our recent episodes. This was part of his kind of one of the pillars of the 100-year portfolio. Are you imagining not just a period of depression or low economic growth, but also a period of double-digit inflation like the 70s? And if so, in that period, gold went from $35 an ounce to, let's say, actually, it was a little bit more than 35 to begin the decade, but 35 to, you know, I don't know, 850, what was it, in 1981? So in about 10 years, it increased about 24 times, right? Huge bull run for gold. Is that where you think we are now for gold? Are we in the beginning of a new bull rise for the gold price?
I do. And I think it goes back to the point you made about the dollar. At least the U.S. has the dollar. That, unfortunately, is, for me, one of the scarier things that people are relying on right now. And I think what comes out of this, so again, these can all be very much longer discussions, but, you know, essentially what, you know, there's a lot of confidence that we didn't see the sort of hyperinflationary environment that a lot of people would have expected when the Fed raised its balance sheet to, you know, $5 trillion and global central banks, you know, essentially, you know, increased their balance sheet, you know, quite significantly. And the reason why is really it was a reinflation of the financial economy, whereas it necessarily was not spread out broadly among the economy. And basically what happened is, you know, the 2008 crisis and the mortgage crisis really was a balance sheet crisis, right? There was true holes in these balance sheets because they lent to people that fundamentally couldn't pay for, you know, a home that's too big and so forth, right? So there was a fundamental solvency issue that they tried to paper over by pumping money into the system. So basically what they did is they released a lot of shadow inflation in the economy, but it wasn't broad inflation like they were actually handing out helicopter money. You know, we didn't actually put $5 trillion new dollars out of nowhere onto Main Street.
Right. It was credit fueled inflation.
Exactly. Yeah. What we actually did is we bought back, you know, the actual debt assets in the economy, you know, mostly treasuries and mortgage securities. We bought them up, in my view, at a marked up price, which allowed these banks to refill the holes in their balance sheet. But it was still an asset swap, you know, at a very static point, it was an asset swap one for one, right? You sell me, you know, $1 billion worth of treasuries, I put another $1 billion in your account. So it's not like we had $2 billion, right? We didn't double the money supply. We just shifted the asset from one place to the other. So I say that's shadow inflation because what it did is it allowed the financial economy to continue to inflate, right? So basically, why were they doing that? They were doing that so that instead of buying more treasuries, if we remove those from the market, it pushed investors and pushed that new cash into the next, you know, further down the credit quality, right? So they wanted people to invest that cash into the economy by removing the other asset, right? Take the asset out, give new liquidity, now go buy the next best asset.
Right. So this was taking the asset out, to be clear for people that are listening, that causes a rise in the price of treasuries and that concurrent drop in the yield, which is part of this whole larger, you know, search for yield phenomenon. So if you want yield, you get lower rung quality assets to deliver that yield.
Exactly. And so the thought was that money would then be reinvested in the marginal, you know, credit for the entrepreneur or small business or something that's actually creating economic growth. But what we actually saw, particularly at the tail end of this, is that you had trillions and trillions of dollars that actually just went back to companies buying back their own stock. Right. So you actually were creating a new balance sheet hole in the economy. So the financial economy was inflating quite significantly. And the managers, the people getting paid by the financial economy, they were seeing inflation in their goods. Right. They were seeing inflation in brunch in Brooklyn. Right. As I always like to say, you know, so that was a financial inflation that then sort of translated, you know, in very small places into the real economy. And typically it was around tech cities, energy hub cities, political cities, and financial cities. So if you're not in one of those four cities, you are not really feeling that new money coming into the economy. Now what's happening yes, we do have a balance sheet hole from these, you know, these reckless companies that were buying back their own stock. So that will have to get filled by these bailout programs. But what you're actually seeing is more and more of these new, you know, response efforts are trying to get the money directly to Main Street, you know, quote unquote, helicopter money. Mm. So I believe this time will be inflationary and far more inflationary than before. And so, yes, that's the second half of the pretty ugly economic story is not only are we going to head into recession, but we're going to start heading into a period of inflation and perhaps even hyperinflation, depending on how bad this goes. And again, I don't say this as, you know, as a gold bug, you know, that's been wrong about calling inflation for the last 10 years. Yeah, I mean, look, I was like everybody else. My first reaction in 2010, 2011 was, hey, this looks highly inflationary. But then as we more and more understood, we actually saw that, yes, it was inflationary, but only for assets, not for the real economy. But all of the policy response that have been drafting up so far is going to be inflationary for the real economy. And again, this is where that volatility in supply chains and volatility in commodities is going to continue to make the world very slow as we come out of this.
But for the time being, though, we're still expanding the money supply by taking on new liabilities. So the Fed is still, it's still a debt-based money expansion. What's interesting, though, is that it's happening during a time where economic growth is collapsing, and it's not really not, in a way that's just, again, it's abnormal. It's not a normal type of collapse where you could use fiscal stimulus, for example, to reignite it in real time. So you're not creating new wealth at the same time as you're increasing the money supply, but you're also increasing the liability side of the balance sheet. So, I mean, I think I do hear what you're saying. My sense is that there is still more deflation to come. I'm curious, you think we're there? We're at the inflation point now?
No. You're absolutely right. And this is where we're going to have another set of false confidence that, you know, we're pumping in another couple trillion into the economy and it's not going to be inflationary. It's not going to at first. And part of that comes back to the commodity economy. So again, right now you had oil prices collapse. That $20 oil that translate into cheap gasoline is yet another economic stimulus, right? So we had that economic stimulus happen in sort of 2013, 2014 with the shale revolution. So we had an economic stimulus from lower energy prices. We will have that, and we will stay in this sort of disinflationary environment around energy prices for a short period of time. But the problem is that doesn't last forever. So at some point, you know, we're going to have a slowing economy and a deflationary prices, both for capacity reasons in labor and in manufacturing, and just, again, you know, slow down activity. But then also, as we come back out of it, we're not going to have all sorts of capacity in the commodity economy. So that's when things start looking 1970s to me. It's probably more of a 2021 story. But, you know, again, you know, markets do have an ability to price that stuff ahead. So we don't know when we're going to start pricing that. But again, I don't see many ways to avoid that those 1970s type scenarios.
When are we going to start seeing volatility on the upside enter the gold market?
So I think we've already seen some of it. And, you know, if you look at the, you know, sort of pinned to my Twitter page right now, I do have a couple gold reports and sort of gold, you know, risk ranges that I've posted. And I actually think we're actually still in a very rational. I think the window in the range is actually quite incredible, right? So our model for gold prices really draws on only two factors. What is the real interest rate? So that's basically your nominal interest rate less inflation. So what is the real interest rate in the economy? And typically real interest rates go lower as there's less growth in the economy. And then what is your energy price? So real interest rates is really a demand factor for gold, and energy prices is really a supply factor for gold. What is the cost of gold to produce? So basically both of those are highly volatile in the market right now, right? So we're going through this major phase transition of, again, a lot of, you know, relative certainty to a lot of uncertainty. And so we don't know if inflation actually falls to, you know, -3-4% and our interest rates are at zero because we don't take them negative, then yes, we could actually have, you know, high positive real interest rates without growth. And in that environment, gold actually would be falling, ironically, right? So that's a a scenario that could take gold to like 1200. But then on the energy side, same thing. You know, our energy, our forward curve has already come down from sort of $60 a barrel down to 50. And of course, the front month price of oil is, you know, down close to 20. So energy prices have been falling, which again is actually a negative price factor for gold. So we're actually in the middle of our risk range right now at 1600. And we could actually see it rationally going anywhere from 1200 to 2100, and neither price would surprise me, which is actually an incredible statement. And I'm sure a lot of people analyzing different parts of the economy have the same type of range, right? And that's, again, that's a fundamental volatility. That's
yeah,
a fundamental,
it's a reflection of the volatility. Yeah.
Exactly.
And to people listening, that's contango in the oil market. Again, for people trying to get their heads around those two words. Josh, you're just getting warmed up, man. I told you we weren't going to do an overtime. Now I realize we probably should have done one. We probably should have transitioned about 20 minutes ago to get into the overtime. But it's all right, because I think doing a, you know, full 2-hour episode with you between the full episode and the overtime is something that I want to do, and I want to really do a lot of reading before we do that, so I'm prepared to have that conversation. But I think this was actually really great. I hope it'll be really helpful for people, and that they'll get something out of it. It was helpful for me. So thank you.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate it. And I guess we probably took it down a path of macroeconomics that probably wasn't the original goal, talking about something very micro. And I apologize for listeners that wanted, you know, an hour and 20 minutes talking about the paper gold market. But we can certainly return to any of these issues anytime. And I'm quite active on Twitter. And, you know, so again, happy to take it any direction, and happy to come back if you'll have me.
Absolutely. So for regular listeners, you know, I usually do overtime segments and release transcripts and rundowns. But because of everything that's happening now, I'm trying to put out more content. So I still want to try and do 4 full episodes every week with rundowns and overtimes and everything else. But I actually want to add to that type of content. And episodes like this with Josh are examples of that. I have another recording that I'm going to be doing tomorrow with Gillian Tett, the editor-at-large of Financial Times. We were supposed to record on Friday. But again, this is something else, Josh. I don't know if you're great. I mean, and Jillian's phenomenal. I don't mean she's not great. I mean, you're great in terms of you went and got a microphone and everything else. But, you know, you can't always ask people to do that. And they're very busy, like, you know, when you're running the world's largest English-speaking financial newspaper. But we were struggling with the tech, and we're going to try again tomorrow. You know, I don't know how great the audio quality is going to be, but I'm kind of struggling to get used to this. You know, like I want to put out content. I know how important it is. I know my listeners want to hear from me, and they want to hear from my guests, and they want to hear these conversations. And I know most of them don't really care about audio quality. It's me that's a giant stickler about it. So I'm still getting used to all of this. I'm also getting used to not, you know, being in person with my guests, which I like the most. But in any case, if you're a regular listener, again, you know the drill. There's no overtime transcript or rundown for this episode, but I would implore you to go and check out the Patreon subscription offering if you haven't already, and subscribe. This is how I support the program. I don't take on sponsors. Believe me, I've had very lucrative offers to have this show sponsored by all sorts of different companies, but I have resisted doing that because I love not having to actually say something that I don't want to say, and that's scripted. So, Josh, unless actually it's Josh, unless you sponsor the show, Josh, in which case I would be happy to take your money. Just write me a check. You let me know, okay? You can send gold bars to me.
Absolutely. Right. But yeah, you have to take gold. That's the
I'm happy to take physical delivery. Physical delivery.
You have to take physical delivery of LNG. So.
Absolutely. We have to talk about that. So everyone can follow Josh on Twitter at Josh Crumb, CRUMB. Josh, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you very much.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Creative Media Design Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/ Hidden Forces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.